Good morning. I'm Dan Proud. I'm the presider this morning. Prairie aspires to be both an open-hearted and open-minded congregation, and we welcome people of every ethnic and religious background, whatever your color, sexual orientation, gender, or family structure. Later in the service, we will invite visitors, guests, and returning friends to introduce yourselves, so that we might get to know you better. On Sunday mornings, we provide a wide variety of services presented either by a Prairie member, which is the case today, or a member of the wider community, or Sandra Ingham. Our opening words will be read by Dean Schroeder.
Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech, or of the press, or the right of people peaceably to assemble, and to petition the government for redress of grievances. The First Amendment.
Now I have the chalice lighting. Ruth Calden will read and I'll do okay. The lighting.
May the light we now kindle inspire us to use our powers to heal and not to harm, to help and not to hinder, to bless and not to curse, to serve you, Spirit of Freedom.
Well, it's my pleasure to introduce my wife, Robin Proud. Robin and I have been members of Prairie since 2002, and she has been speaking on and off many times, mostly about UU women, and this is a little departure from the norm. I might say a couple things about Robin that you, by way of introduction, she's a graduate of Carleton College. She was a transplant from the East Coast, where she grew up in upstate Pennsylvania. And we have two children, one in Minneapolis, one in St. Louis. Robin has been active in Toastmasters for years and years, and loves to speak, so she gets her wish again today. And we'll have a time for questions after her presentation.
Thanks. Well, it's only fair that I speak today, because I think the last time I spoke here was the day we changed the clocks in the spring, and some people didn't make it on time. I had this idea, I think in August, after the Charlottesville, Virginia incidents, that I noticed, I'd seen a few op-eds and articles about free speech, hate speech, often it had to do with campuses. So I thought, well, I'll need to do some research to go back and find these articles and get information. As it turned out, over the last 2 months, all I had to do was stand back as a fire hose of opinions and articles and events washed over me and try to condense these enough for our program. So what I'm going to do actually is to just give you some information from various articles and incidents that have happened here, and then open it up for questions. I do not have the answer to this question about where do we draw the line. We're going to look at some of the things that have happened and what some people have said about it. We'll start right here at UW-Madison. An article from the Progressive August-September magazine by Bill Luders, who is the managing editor, summarized an event that happened about a year ago, November 2016. A student group at UW-Madison brought in conservative commentator Ben Shapiro. More than 400 people, mostly students, turned out to hear him. A smaller group of about 20 people came to keep him from being heard. The interruptions, mostly chants of shame and safety, began right away, prompting Shapiro to crack, "At least wait until I say something that offends you before being offended." His supporters shouted, USA, USA. The protesters gathered in front of the stage shouting safety, answered by cries from the audience of free speech matters. Eventually, police prodded the protesters to exit. They headed out, a few shouting F white supremacy. Shapiro responded with a double-barreled middle finger salute. So this was really a high academic standard here that both sides were on. The protesters skipped the rest of Shapiro's talk, including the question and answer period where they could have challenged what he had to say. Now, he is a gleeful provocateur on the right. And what one of the protesters said, Ricardo Cortez de la Cruz II, a UW Madison Jr. and member of the Black Liberation Action Coalition, told the Capital Times, I don't trust that the people in that room will understand what he's saying. What I mean by that is they may feel empowered by his speech to hang nooses from the balcony of a frat house or call black people names on the street or make fun of LGBT members. According to De La Cruz, speech that threatens others' feelings or constitutes racism should not be allowed. I think that's when it comes into hate speech, he said. He added, as a rapper, of course, I wouldn't like my speech to be limited just because I say something offensive. So they said, don't laugh. Not all offensive speech is hate speech. There are certain kinds of speech that the First Amendment does not protect. Threats, fighting words, defamation, harassment. But when the issue is hurt feelings, attempts to restrict who is allowed to say what are doomed to incoherence. So then this mentioned a couple incidents this year at UC Berkeley and Middlebury, where there was actually some violence that occurred as a result of conservative speakers and protests against them. Political conservatives responded by claiming the high ground, casting themselves as defenders of the First Amendment. Bills calling for penalties on students who interfere with free speech rights were introduced in a number of states, notably Wisconsin. Now, interestingly, this Wisconsin Campus Free Speech Act that was championed by our congressional leaders says that they were some unlikely free speech crusaders. Republicans in the state legislature uttered nary a peep when police arrested hundreds of protesters from 2011 to 2013 at the Capitol for such offenses as chanting and holding signs. One man said, "What am I being arrested for? I know I have a bad singing voice." So what this writer is saying is that in the long run, this went against what the protesters really wanted. And he concludes, the behavior of the protesters at this talk was disgraceful. They conveyed to the world that Shapiro's ideas are so powerful that people, that is, people other than themselves, cannot be trusted to hear them. They played right into his hands, enlivening his speech and helping make his case that the left consists of intolerant bullies. They gave ammunition to legislators, itching for a reason, any reason, to crack down on dissent. And still they did not prevent Shapiro from being heard, they just made it harder. His ideas still had to stand or fall on their own merit, so do the actions of the protesters. It is not necessary that their obnoxious behavior be punished by the government for it to be discredited. They have achieved that already. So that was from the Progressive. Now for a little different view though, August 14th, an op-ed in the New York Times from a woman named Kianga Yamata Taylor, who is African-American, and she is a professor of African-American studies, I believe. She said, the right-wing media is obsessed with the supposed stifling of free speech on campuses, but it seems to care only about protecting speech it likes. The double standard is especially striking in the internet era. And so what happened to her was she gave a commencement address at Hampshire College. In a short moment of that speech, she called Trump, President Trump, a racist, sexist megalomaniac. Fox News created a segment out of this and ran the clip repeatedly over 4 days with the headline, Princeton Professor Goes on Anti-POTUS Tirade. That a junior faculty member of Princeton was critical of Mr. Trump in a speech at a small liberal arts college should not be surprising, nor was it newsworthy in any meaningful sense of the term. but it did incite Fox viewers. Within hours, invective filled my inbox. I received emails that I would be lynched, shot, and raped. And Princeton's Department of African American Studies was so flooded with hate that the locks on the doors had to be changed. And then she says she actually had to cancel a tour she was giving about her book From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation because of security concerns. She says, when it comes to protecting the speech of people who are most vulnerable to being intimidated into silence, like people of color and gay people, conservatives either are suspiciously quiet or drive further intimidation with wildly negative news coverage. And she mentioned that while the white right-wing media is wringing its hands about suppressive leftist, openly racist and fascist sympathizing organizations are recruiting young white people on campuses. Conservative pundits have precious little to say when campuses are defiled with swastikas, nooses, and racist flyers, but cry foul when people like Richard Spencer, Milo Yiannopoulos, and Ann Coulter are met with protest. In the coming school years, those who are quick to defend the rights of white nationalists and neo-Nazis to speak on campus must be just as vigilant about protecting the rights of faculty and students to speak out against them or risk revealing their hypocrisy. And at this time, September 24th, there was an event announced for Berkeley, California, Free Speech Week. So this article in the New York Times talks about how a class called Symplectic Geometry, a high-level course in mathematics, was going to be canceled by its professor, Katrin Wehrheim, because of concerns about the scheduled appearance of these speakers. Berkeley, which has become during the Trump presidency an ideological battleground in the national debate over free speech, is bracing for several days of disruption when a group of conservative speakers is set to appear on campus as part of an event billed Free Speech Week. And this included Steve Bannon, Ann Coulter, and Milo Yiannopoulos, and others. So there was a lot of confusion or question about how should people react? Should they ignore this? Should they stay away because there actually might be violence? Should they protest? Erwin Chemerinsky, the dean of the Berkeley Law School and one of the nation's leading First Amendment experts, and we'll hear from him again in a moment, he said, the difficulty is that there's not any consensus among students or faculty about what to do. One view shared by people on both sides of the free speech debate is that the university's role as a sanctuary of learning is being undermined by bands of outsiders who are using Berkeley's reputation as a liberal bastion to prove a point. And this month, September, Ben Shapiro, the same person we had at the UW-Madison, spoke at Berkeley in September amid a heavy police presence that cost the university $600,000. He said he wanted to prove that there are students who do want to hear different views. And that certainly could be. However, one graduate student said, 99% of us just want to go to class and study. To his critics, Mr. Yiannopoulos is using the Berkeley controversy as self-promotion to sell more books. In denouncing what he calls a liberal intolerance of opposing views, Mr. Yiannopoulos is capitalizing on the large numbers of college students who believe in limiting the scope of speech on campus beyond what is allowed by the First Amendment. According to a survey conducted in August and made public on the Brookings Institution website, a plurality of college students, polled 44%, believed that hate speech was not protected by the First Amendment. Today's students tend to believe in a narrower interpretation of the First Amendment than is actually true, said the author of the study. There is this idea that what is permissible to say should be judged in large part by its impact on a listener. An anthropology professor was quoted, who she's teaching a course on the relationship between free speech and hate speech. She said, words can be like rape. They can destroy you. And today's students have grown up with anti-bullying and some different views of how people should behave, perhaps, than some of us did. Watching this debate attentively but warily are the veterans of the original free speech movement, in Berkeley who are now in their 70s. Kathleen Piper, an artist, said, "She and other veterans of the movement disagreed with the positions of the right-wing speakers coming to campus, but she said there was a consensus among them that they should be allowed to speak. I think a person needs to hear stuff that they don't agree with," Ms. Piper said. "They need the opportunity of discovering they are not going to melt if somebody says something ugly to them. I don't think we should be protected from those experiences." In contrast to this position, Professor Wehrheim, the geometry professor, whose German heritage informs a stance that certain speech should be banned from campus, she said, "Americans are missing the profound analogies between present-day U.S. developments and German history. In Germany today," Professor Wehrheim said, "you will get jailed for certain speech, and I think that is absolutely the right thing." Now, as it happened, Yiannopoulos Free Speech Week never came off. It fell apart. With each side, he accused the university of making it too difficult, but there certainly are some opinions that some of these speakers said they had never actually agreed to speak there. Was the whole thing a publicity stunt? Now, at this time, we have an article also from The Guardian from England, and it's amazing sometimes how much interest and knowledge other countries have about our internal affairs that we rarely have about theirs. And what The Guardian had to say was that they didn't feel this was a free speech issue. They said, "Bannon, Coulter, and their cohorts face opposition wherever they go because they advocate policies such as deportation and discrimination based on religion that do harm to hundreds of thousands of ordinary people who have millions of friends prepared to shout about it." And they said, "This is not a crisis of free speech. None of these individuals have any difficulty at all getting their views across. Steve Bannon was the chief strategist of the most powerful leader in the world. Every Coulter book has been a bestseller. Yiannopoulos, despite recently inflicting on himself the kind of scandal that would have buried most careers, enjoys the continuing support of more than 2 million followers on Facebook. And yet they weep and gnash their teeth." Then, just to show that there are a number of other areas where this free speech discussion is going, one page from The Week magazine, September 29th, 2017, has Jemele Hill, a black woman sports anchor at ESPN, who on her private tweet said that Trump was a white supremacist, and then there were calls from the White House and the president's spokespeople for her to be fired. And this was then, of course, followed by the discussions about football players kneeling during the national anthem and whether that should be allowed or not. And at the same time, there's an example the same week, an Ohio firefighter was suspended for saying he'd rather save a dog than an African-American from a burning building. One dog is more important than a million N-words, Tyler Roysden wrote on Facebook. He was immediately suspended by Franklin Township officials for conduct unbecoming a township employee. Roysden's wife said her husband had apologized, but added that everyone is entitled to their own opinion. Now, there is another aspect to this. If you are employed by a company, a government entity, an institution, there actually could be restrictions or direction on what you can and can't say, because in a sense you are representing that organization. So Erwin Chemerinsky, where's my book? Oh, here. Dean and professor of law at UC Berkeley, along with Howard Gilman, chancellor and professor of law, political science, and history at UC Irvine, came out with this book in September of this year, Free Speech on Campus. And this summarizes some of the history, and then I think the main reason that they wrote this was so that campuses would have an idea what they can and can't do. He was the one who said, "No one seems to be sure what we can or should do." So there's an extended interview with him from the New York Times. Some of the things he mentioned is, "I think we have to be attentive to the fact that many students want to restrict speech because of very laudable instincts. They want to protect other students from hate speech. They want to create an inclusive community for all. But the response to hate speech can't be to prohibit and punish it. It's unconstitutional. We have to find other ways to create inclusive communities. The law under the First Amendment is clear. Hate speech is protected speech. And here's an interesting example of what happened when people tried to work against this. Over 300 colleges and universities adopted hate speech codes in the early 1990s. Every one to be challenged in court was ruled unconstitutional. And there are good reasons for that. After some really ugly incidents at the University of Michigan in the late 1980s, the school adopted a hate speech code that was undoubtedly well-intentioned. These were mostly anti-black, things with nooses, horrible things being written. But a federal court declared this code unconstitutional in part because it was so vague. And during the years Michigan's speech code was on the books, more than 20 black students were charged with racist speech by white students. There wasn't a single instance of a white student being punished for racist speech, even though that was what had prompted the drafting of the Michigan speech code in the first place. It's part of a much bigger historical pattern. When hate speech codes or laws are adopted, they are most often directed at the very groups they're meant to protect. And then he talked about how young people have a different view of speech. They weren't around for the civil rights protests of the 1960s, which were a free speech, freedom of assembly issue. The Vietnam War protests, the 19th Amendment that gave women the right to vote was the product of demonstrations and speech. But now many students associate free speech with the internet, which is crude and cruel. And just think if Chrysanthemum in our story had to go home and there see many more taunts about her name, even while she was at home and couldn't enjoy her Parcheesi games. So students have noble motives in this. And Irwin says, campuses don't need to stand behind offensive speakers. I think it's important for campus officials to respond to and condemn hate speech. Just because the First Amendment protects a right to say something doesn't mean it should be said. And there's something about inviting speakers in the first place. It's one thing if a group actually chooses to invite them. When I was at my Carleton reunion last year, a dean talked about that sometimes these provocative speakers will contact the campus and sort of insist on being invited. So the students do not have to invite someone who is saying, I'm available. The law is also clear that even in places that are open to speech, there can be time, place, and manner restrictions. There's a right to speak on the campus, but there is no right to come into my classroom and shout me down. There's a right to use public streets and sidewalks, but a city can prevent trucks with sound amplification equipment from playing music in the middle of the night. And dormitories are also a very special place. It's their home. But restrictions cannot be content-based. For instance, you could say that no one is allowed to hang flags from their window, but you can't say that no one is allowed to hang Confederate flags from their window. And of course, there is no right to engage in violence. Irwin concludes, it's important to recognize that a public university has no choice but to allow speakers on campus, even if their message is regarded as hateful or racist. If the campus tried to exclude such a speaker, it would get sued, and the speaker would win, and likely would be made a martyr in the process. But the campus must ensure safety for its students, staff, and faculty. This might include regulating where the speaker is allowed to be present, and likely will include more of a police presence. But he concludes, there's no way to empower a government or campus administration to restrict speech without allowing for the possibility that tomorrow it will be our speech that is restricted. And we have a similar comment in the New York Times Book Review of all places, Adam Kirsch, poet and critic, who says, political speech involves making claims about what is true. The planet is warming. The president is a criminal. Jews are out to destroy white America. If I disagree with your truth claim, then I believe you are either ignorant or a liar. And it's not obvious why ignorance and lies deserve any kind of respect. Shouldn't I use every means in my power to stop you from spreading falsehood? Isn't it my moral responsibility to do so? And he says, liberalism is founded on the belief that we should tolerate one another's error, not because we approve of it, but to avoid the violence that would result if we each sought to silence the other. The price of this toleration is that we must constantly put up with hearing speech that we consider wrong. And then he said, if there was ever a group whose speech appears to me to be obviously evil and dangerous, it is the white supremacists who marched in Charlottesville. But the President of the United States is sympathetic to white supremacists. To him, it is the mythical alt-left that presents the real threat. If he had the power to suppress freedom of speech, he would use it to silence those people. It's better for me for no one to possess that power than to entrust it to someone who might regard me as an enemy. Campus leftists who believe they're serving the cause of goodness and truth by silencing right-wing speakers are living in a fool's paradise because they temporarily inhabit an environment where they are in the majority. When they graduate, they will find that many people, including people in power, think they are the ones who are wrong and dangerous. And this is not a simple question. The ACLU is agonizing over the same issue. The ACLU famously has defended the Ku Klux Klan, Nazis marching in Skokie some decades ago, a pastor who wanted to burn the Quran. But now, after Charlottesville, a group of staff members from the ACLU sent an open letter saying, our broader mission, which includes advancing the racial justice guarantees in the Constitution and elsewhere, not just the First Amendment, continues to be undermined by our rigid stance. In response, the executive director, Anthony Romero, said, retreating from its longstanding defense of free speech, even hate speech, is not going to happen. He says, the ACLU defends speech from government censorship, including and especially hateful speech in times when it's being shut down. Now, he did say they do not represent groups seeking to hold armed rallies, and this is not a change in approach. As far back as 1934, when the original Nazis wanted to assemble, the ACLU defended them, but it was opposed to permitting Nazis to engage in, quote, drilling with arms, that is, wielding weapons in public. So even within the ACLU, there's not always a clear point of where we should draw the line. October 9th, The New Yorker, flip-flopping on free speech. Ronald Reagan was running for governor in California in 1966. He complained about undergraduate malcontents, and they were inviting some inappropriate speakers, such as Stokely Carmichael, to speak on black power. We cannot have the university campus used as a base from which to foment riots, Reagan warned. Carmichael actually showed up in a suit and tie and spoke to 10,000 people. But maybe Reagan's folks got the upper hand in the long run because this is the start of his rise. And then this contrasted it with this year's free speech event at Berkeley. So this author, Jill Lepore, says, in the half century between the elections of Governor Reagan and President Trump, the left and right would appear to have switched sides, the left fighting against free speech and the right fighting for it. And he does say it's not entirely wrong. An unwillingness to engage with conservative thought, an aversion to debate, and a weakened commitment to free speech are among the failures of the left, she says. Campus protesters have tried to silence not only alt-right gadflies, but also serious, if controversial, policymakers. James Comey, former FBI director, was shouted down by students at Howard University. When he spoke about the importance of conversation, one protester called out, "White supremacy is not a debate." However, Comey was heckled, but when he finished, the crowd gave him a standing ovation. The same day, Trump called for the firing of NFL players who protest racial injustice by kneeling during the national anthem. So that's where the right's view of free speech is limited to certain things, as well as the left. Some of this changed during the 1970s. The No Platform movement was founded in 1974 by a British student group that banned any speaker holding racist or fascist views. One influence was Herbert Marcuse, who argued that liberals' commitment to open debate was absurd because free speech had become a form of oppression. In the 80s, there were a lot of information from the field of trauma studies which understood words as harm. But she concludes, restricting speech is like trying to waltz with a wolf. Every hate speech code that has been challenged in court has been found unconstitutional. Some have been lifted, others disavowed. Nevertheless, a generation has come of age knowing nothing but the wolf. And it mentions this study where a number of students believe that colleges should prohibit speech or expression of viewpoints that are offensive or biased against certain groups of people. October 11th, Charles Murray spoke at the University of Michigan. Protesters screamed, set off ear-splitting cell phone alarms, and played the Imperial March, Darth Vader's theme in Star Wars, which actually is a bit amusing, but they were doing this while he was supposed to be speaking, turned off lights, and displayed a projection with the words white supremacist on the wall with an arrow pointing at Mr. Murray. Others held signs, "We punch white supremacists." After 45 minutes of pandemonium, the student protesters left. Mr. Murray, he's famous for his bell curve, which apparently it said that black people were less intelligent than white people, is how that could be taken. But then he actually gave his speech, which was about the 2016 election and how we got stuck with President Trump, who Mr. Murray fiercely opposes. I thought, well, I have plenty for this talk, but then, I think that was Thursday night, I saw a new thing at Reed College, which is literally the most liberal college in the country. There's a huge debate going on. Students call Reedies Against Racism, RAR, decided to protest the humanities course that all freshmen take, and they went into the actual classes, held up signs, and did other things that were disruptive. One of the professors said that she felt threatened, and she is a gay mixed-race woman. And an interesting, people who did not participate in these protests were called out by name on the student Facebook and accused of being supremacists and other things. Interestingly, when the new season started up again, the new year, the freshmen who were actually in the course pushed back and said, "We're here for this course and we want to learn this and we don't want to be disruptive." Some of the upper class students were actually barred from the class. So that's an ongoing issue that just came up in the last few days. And just to return here, just to throw in something totally different, the Guggenheim Museum in New York had an exhibit with some art that people felt showed cruelty to animals, or cruelty to animals might have occurred while creating this art. And after extended protests, the Guggenheim closed the exhibit. Frankfurt Book Fair, violence as a result of debates. And then to return to where we started with the UW, the recent isthmus, Michael Cummins, he feels that what the UW Regents did was right with the free speech rule because the protest that students were engaged in was actually hurting their cause. Well, actually, he quotes columnist Michelle Goldberg, who says, "You cannot overstate how gleeful the right is whenever one of these incidents breaks out, that is, students disrupting a speaker they don't agree with. The alt-right leaders consider leftist speech interference to be a prime recruiting tool. I wish that progressives would stop giving them these gift-wrapped presents." After the Regents passed the new policy, Fox News contributor Katie Pavlich visited the Madison campus to speak in support of firearms ownership. A group of about 20 people protested peacefully outside the venue. They said that the board's policy changed the way the protest was conducted. So he says, in acting when they did, the Regents surely headed off the delivery of a second gift-wrapped present with a Wisconsin return address. So that's one opinion. So all of this seemed to be going in the direction that, awful as hate speech is, it must be allowed. But I had this nagging feeling that I, as a white middle-class person, may not be the one who can actually define this. So I found something just recently here from Daily Coast, which is from a poster named Keener. He quotes, and this is the last thing I have here before we discuss this, he quotes from the Knight Syndicate of 1929 newspaper, "Lynchings in 1928 were fewer than in any year in 50 years, only 11 reported, which is encouraging. On the other hand, interference with public meetings and the right to free speech increased in 1928 considerably. Whether it is more harmful to snuff out a few lives by lynching or to discourage freedom of speech among millions in contempt of the Constitution is a question. It costs many lives to establish free speech. The author was one of the most celebrated news editors of all time, utopian socialist Arthur Brisbane. So he seemed to be saying that we needed to defend freedom of speech and assembly, and if some violence came out of it, that was the cost that needed to be paid. He presents lynching as an unfortunate consequence of supporting free speech, but this writer says it's hard to get this more wrong. Lynching was a systemic practice to keep black populations in fear of demanding their constitutional rights, such as rights of association, speech, commerce, or political participation. Lynching was the mechanism by which free speech and right of assembly is denied to populations. And the equivalent today, a prominent black academic detailed on Twitter the institutional support required to support an academic woman of color who dares to voice public opinions on social media. Here are some of the things your institution might need to provide. A staff member or student to go through your email to remove the hate mail, triage death or rape threats, and refer legal matters to the police. A desk and office far away from public foot traffic, preferably with an administrative assistant to head off any individuals heading to your office unannounced. A help desk or assistant to screen your calls, since your phone will be rendered useless. And you will have to cut through organized abuse each time you want to make a point, knowing that every success you achieve will bring more risk and stress to you and those you love. This is what you will live with, a level of constant noise and pervasive threat in your life that would push the average white male liberal columnist into a mental breakdown. It's not lynching, true, but the logic is similar: to increase the cost of speech of marginalized voices, to make what is guaranteed in principle too expensive to exercise in practice. And like lynching, the idea is to mob and target specific public figures to make an example of them. The abuse is the free speech issue. Kicking Nazis off of Twitter reduces the platform of a small number of people who are using that platform to terrify and silence others. Leaving them on suppresses the voices of entire classes of female intellectuals, people of color, and any other subgroup the mob decides to turn its spotlight towards when that subgroup gets too uppity. So it's very different in some countries in Europe that, for instance, the Nazi salute is not allowed, or denying the Holocaust, and we don't have that here. I think the issue is that at some point, who decides what is true or not, and there are certainly some countries around the world where you can't make fun of the president, that would put our comedians out of work, but you can't state certain things, and some of our courts may be changing so that they may back certain things that we think are patently false. So that's always the risk. So thank you, everyone. Our closing words: forgive us that often we forgive ourselves so easily and others so hardly. Forgive us that we expect perfection from those to whom we show none. Forgive us for repelling people by the way we set a good example. Forgive us the folly of trying to improve a friend. Forbid that we should use our little idea of goodness as a spear to wound those who are different. Forbid that we should feel superior to others when we are only more shielded. And may we encourage the secret struggle of every person. So join us for conversation and coffee.